This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 17 presidential hopefuls took two stages last night in Cleveland in what was billed as the first GOP debate. Was there a winner in either event? Plus, political satirist and comedian Jon Stewart completed his 16-year run on The Daily Show last night. We'll hear his parting words. At the state level, Governor McCrory makes changes to his cabinet. What does that mean for 2016? Joining me to talk about this and more is political junkie Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us, Michael Bitzer, Catawba College Provost and Political Science Professor. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, last night everybody said, you got to watch the TV, a big event coming out of Cleveland. So I turn it on 15 minutes in. I say, wait, this is not the induction awards for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What's going on here?
It was the Hall of Fame. I mean, look, I'm old enough to remember the Lincoln-Douglas debate. This was far more entertaining. And while we're supposed to get some information about how these guys would be, or gal, would be the next president, I still think it was very instructive, even with all the sideshows and the comedies and the wise ass responses.
Even from guys like me. So tell me how were you instructed? How are you edified this morning?
Well, I always thought that Donald Trump was a serious candidate. I always thought that he was no, I'm kidding. No, but I thought what was interesting is that we kept in the days and the weeks leading up to this debate, and the anticipation, as you probably know, was just unbelievable. I don't remember ever being this, you know, intense for a multi-candidate debate. But everybody was thinking, how are the candidates going to prepare? How are they going to deal with Donald Trump? And as it turned out, it was the Fox broadcasters, it was the Fox moderators that really put Donald Trump on his heels and really set the tone for the debate.
All right, Michael Bitzer, what do you think?
I agree. I think it was certainly one of the winners last night was Megyn Kelly. I mean, she came out, if Fox News is seen as kind of the safe home for Republicans and conservatives, she kind of had an axe to grind and really swung that axe hard towards a lot of the candidates, but in particularly to Donald Trump. I mean, she basically just called him to the floor, and I think he was kind of taken aback by, you know, don't you know that I'm the leader here in terms of the polling? Don't you know who I am? And I think it really kind of exposed that he does not have the kind of substantive policy behind the kind of inflated rhetoric that he's been going around and really kind of claiming in terms of his polling numbers.
Yeah, well,
can I just say something? Yeah, Michael is exactly right, but I think the appeal of Donald Trump was that he never needed to have that kind of substantive policy decisions and policies in his campaign. It was just like I'm mad as hell and I won't take it anymore. And I think that explains a lot of one of his big rise in the polls.
Yeah, but let's hear how that played out last night and then talk about what effect it might have. Let's listen.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only
is
Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. Your Twitter account.
Thank you.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct. I've been challenged by so many people, and I don't frankly have time for total political correctness. And to be honest with you, this country doesn't have time either. This country is in big trouble. We don't win anymore. We lose to China. We lose to Mexico, both in trade and at the border. We lose to everybody. And frankly, what I say, and oftentimes it's fun, it's kidding, we have a good time, what I say is what I say. And honestly, Megan, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably maybe not be based on the way you have treated me, but I wouldn't do that. But you know what? We need strength, we need energy, we need quickness, and we need brain in this country to turn it around.
I kid America because I love it. It's Michael Bitzer, let me ask you about this, though, the substantive thing. I mean, the guy's still kind of leading in the polls. We know it's very early. I mean, how long do you think he can go on sort of this way, just sort of saying political correctness is the problem and I'm going to turn it around, we're going to win?
Yeah, I think we're in uncharted territory. I'm trying to remember in the many years that I've studied politics, any kind of Republican or Democratic presidential primary season like this with somebody who is so not a politician, but is tapping into, I think, the voice of contempt, particularly within the Republican Party. There is a lot of contempt and anger associated with folks within the Republican Party, and I think Donald Trump has tapped into it and is using that and deflecting everything else that gets thrown his way with these kind of grandiose statements of, we need to make America better. It's you know, tapping into an anger, but it's more about contempt for the political elites and leadership, particularly within the Republican Party.
Well, on the other side, several pundits declared Ohio Governor John Kasich the winner of the 9 p.m. event. He was asked how, given his stance on opposition to gay marriage, how would he respond if one of his children told him he was gay? And here's what he said.
Well, look, I'm an old-fashioned person here, and I happen to believe in traditional marriage. But I've also said the court has ruled.
But how would you explain
your child? Megan, the court has ruled, and I said we'll accept it. And guess what? I just went to a wedding of a friend of mine who happens to be gay. Because somebody doesn't think the way I do doesn't mean that I can't care about them or I can't love them. So if one of my daughters happened to be that, of course I would love them and I would accept them. Because you know what? That's what we're taught when we have strong faith. So issues like that are planted to divide us. I think the simple fact of the matter is, and this is where I would agree with Jeb, and I've been saying it all along, we need to give everybody a chance, treat everybody with respect, and let them share in this great American dream that we have, Megan. So, look, I'm going to love my daughters. I'm going to love them no matter what they do, because you know what? God gives me unconditional love. I'm going to give it to my family and my friends and the people around me.
Ken, what do you make of that? And again, in light of what Michael Bitzer has just said, you know, the idea that, I mean, the fact is the Republican Party has been the anti-government party since Ronald Reagan, right? Ronald Reagan runs against the government, wins twice. And from that moment onward, the Republican Party keeps moving farther and farther away from government and elites. And now for the first time, a guy who says, I don't want any part of it at all, is actually leading in the polls. And a level-headed guy like John Kasich is way behind. So is this going to sort of straighten itself out? What do you think is going to happen? Ken?
Well, no way of predicting, as you know, as Michael pointed out, there's absolutely no way of predicting anything that's going to happen because Donald Trump has been rewriting the rules as he's gone along. And in answer to your earlier question, one quick thing, Ross Perot reminds me a lot of what Donald Trump is doing now. He was anti-government, he was anti both parties, but once his misuse of the facts started to come out and was pointed out by journalists. Once he started saying that he went to a NAACP convention, he talked about you people, and people said, oh, my goodness, what is going on here? Ross Perot could not get away with that, and Donald Trump seems to be for some reason. One thing about John Kasich, though, if anybody is the compassionate conservative in this race, and, of course, that was George W. Bush's claim to fame in 2000, it seems to be John Kasich. And I think it's pretty remarkable, given the fact that in so many earlier debates, we always hear this red meat towards the four conservatives, and the audience will just, you know, grab it up and love it. For him to talk about compassion towards gays and same-sex marriages and things like that, and to hear the audience applaud, I don't know. I mean, maybe either it's a new Republican Party, which I doubt, or more likely it was in Cleveland and this was home turf for John Kasich. And there were a lot of pro-Kasich folks in the audience. But it was interesting to talk about gay marriage and hear the audience applaud at a Republican debate.
What do you make of that, Michael? Yeah.
I agree, and I think that clip was a wonderful clip for a general election September-October time frame. But what we're talking about is the primary. And the real question that I have is, will that play particularly with social evangelical conservatives that, you know, coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, basically legalizing gay marriage across the country, will they be willing and receptive to hearing that kind of compassionate message when it goes against a very fundamental core belief of theirs? And that's where I think Kasich, Bush, certainly, Chris Christie, you know, they're all fighting for this same lane within the Republican Party, but perhaps the other lanes are bigger and they're being forced to all play within that one central lane there that they have to go into.
Or the whole road has moved so far to the right that everything has shifted, right?
And well, we'd be remiss. Maybe they're on an exit, and everybody else is still on the freeway.
Hey, I got to get Jeb Bush in here. He's the guy everybody thought would be the front runner by now. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Governor Bush, I want to ask you, on the subject of name-calling of your fellow candidates, a story appeared today quoting an anonymous GOP donor who said you called Mr. Trump a clown, a buffoon,
Something else
that cannot be repeated on television.
None of which is true.
Is it true?
No, it's not true. But I have said that Mr. Trump's language is divisive. I want to win. I want one of these people here, or the ones at 5 o'clock, to be the next president of the United States. We're not going to win by doing what Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton do each and every day, dividing the country, creating a grievance kind of environment. We're going to win when we unite people with a hopeful, optimistic message.
All right. Well, we're going to hear what Michael Bitzer and Ken Rudin have to say about that and more when our conversation about the Republican debates and the exit of Jon Stewart, all things political, today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and because you haven't had enough, we are analyzing last night's GOP debate events in Fox last night with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and Catawba College politics professor Michael Bitzer. And just before the break, we heard Jeb Bush essentially answering a question whether or not he called Donald Trump nasty names. I got a couple of questions about that. But Ken Rudin, let me start with you. How do you think Jeb Bush did last night in that big field?
I thought it was very interesting that nobody attacked him. I mean, other than Hillary Clinton, who attacked him pretty strongly the other day, but nobody took him on. You know, we saw the Rand Paul versus Chris Christie battle. We saw a lot of course, people ganging up on Donald Trump, but nobody seemed to take Jeb Bush on. And what I also thought was interesting is that while in the beginning of the debate he seemed a little, Jeb Bush seemed a little off his game, a little tentative, when he was asked about Common Core education standards, which is so controversial in the Republican Party, I thought he gave a very definitive and strong and emphatic support for his policies on education, and I think he got stronger as the debate went on.
Michael Bitzer, I'll ask you to answer that, but also maybe in this context, what is his strategy and his goal going into this? I mean, a lot of people consider him in the long run the front runner. Now he's in a field of 10. All he can do is mess up, it seems to me. How do you approach a debate like this if you're Jeb Bush?
Well, that's a good question. I think he did get better, but he still seemed to me to be still rough around the edges. And the one question that he just knew he was going to get and is going to probably continue to get is, how does he differentiate himself from his father and, more importantly, from his brother? And he hasn't quite hit the right notes to really kind of, other than, I am my own man. Well, you can keep saying that, but you've got to be able to really substantively provide the examples of saying, I'm not W, I am Jeb. And I thought he was at times a little flat. I thought also Scott Walker just seemed to be really flat in comparison to the reports that we've heard coming out of Iowa about his energy and his enthusiasm and his fire. He was just really kind of milquetoast up there on the stage. The person I thought that really had the poise and the preparation and the presentation was Marco Rubio. And I wouldn't be surprised if he gets a little bit of a bump, maybe, you know, becomes the anti-Trump candidate. But with all those four candidates kind of in the middle, there is that battle going on as to who is not Donald Trump, but who takes the lead.
Well, this might be a question for Dan Ariely, who's not with us. But, I mean, I'm wondering, in a group like that, you talked about his energy, Michael Bitzer, you're always sort of in the context, right? So you're in on a panel of these 10 characters. You've got a guy like Donald Trump who's just going to say whatever he wants at any energy level he needs to. In a way, you're always sort of compared to the group that you're up to and up on the stage with. Sure. And it's a very different venue. So I guess maybe I'll put the question to you. Sort of how does that change the dynamics and how these candidates look up on a stage with each other versus on the campaign stump when they're just making a speech to their faithful?
Well, look at the response that Donald Trump is the perfect example. From that moment he announced his candidacy during that majestic escalator ride down Trump Towers. And, of course, he had the audience with him. He had his speech prepared or as much as he can prepare it. But when he gets put on the defensive, he looks kind of like deer in the headlights at times. I mean, when Megyn Kelly went after him on the fat pigs and the dogs and the slobs. I mean, basically, there's no to defend that kind of language by saying, well, I'm not politically correct. I mean, my goodness, think of how Hillary Clinton will love to talk about the Republican war on women. This is beyond the war on women. This is just disgraceful. But I disagree that sometimes when you have Scott Walker seem to, getting the crowds really excited in Iowa and then seem to kind of be mumbling during most of the debate last night. And Ted Cruz is also very interesting because what I saw of Ted Cruz last night and what I see him on the stump as well is pretty similar. He is very in command of the facts. Whether you like the fact that he calls, Mitch McConnell a liar or not and goes after fellow Republicans is one thing. But he just seems to be, if you want the Republican red meat without having the nonsense of a Donald Trump, you have to watch Ted Cruz, especially in these early conservative states.
Well, you talked about Scott Walker, and I mean, looking, and I think Michael Bitzer said he looked a little flat, although I do think, as we'll hear in this clip, he might have gotten the biggest laugh of the night. Let's listen.
Well, first off, for the cyber attack with Russia the other day, it's sad to think right now, but probably the Russian and Chinese government know more about Hillary Clinton's email server than do the members of the United States Congress. And that has put our national security at risk. If I'm president, he won't think about that.
There you go. Michael Bitzer.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was a perfectly well-rehearsed line. And, we knew that was going to be coming. And he made that context and pivoted to the either the attack on Obama or the attack on Hillary Clinton. But I think the format of the debate really constricts the candidates. Remember, they are only talking in one-minute bites. Mm-hmm. And to really get the flavor of something, to really delve deep into it, and with 10 candidates on the stage, it's almost impossible to have the kind of deep engagement that folks want. But if you can go for the quick line, like China and Russia know more about Hillary's emails than we do, that's going to certainly play well and also be kind of the things that people talk about the next morning and for the next couple of days.
Well, I guess that gets you to the ultimate strategy on this very early debate when clearly there were 10 candidates on one stage, five on another. The idea that maybe that's what you're going for, or each candidate has, one candidate might say, all I have to do is not mess up. Another one says, let's just come up with a memorable line. I mean, it seems to me the dynamics of an event like this, sort of dictate how things are going to come out more than, as you say, Michael Bitzer, any kind of substantive conversation. Ken, what do you think about that?
I agree completely. I mean, when you think of past debates, you don't think of clever things that candidates said. What you think of are the gaffes and the embarrassment. I mean, unfortunately, Rick Perry, who I thought, did fine in the early debate, the kids' table debate at 5 p.m., but I thought he did fine. And yet, when you think of gaffes and how debates can ruin a candidate, I mean, nobody comes to the forefront more than Rick Perry.
Well, or one-liners, where's the beef, or John Kennedy, or that sort of thing. I mean, I still remember that.
But when you think of where's the beef, those are mostly one-on-one. Well, of course, where's the beef was Mondale against Gary Hart and several other Democrats. But as you're exactly right, when you have 10 candidates on stage, it's hard to point out. But look at this. We had a two-hour debate last night, and you think of Donald Trump dominating it. Donald Trump spoke for 10 minutes and 31 seconds. The second place was Jeb Bush with 8 minutes and 47 seconds. So you think of all this time they have, they really don't have that much time. And that's why I think when you think of Ben Carson's closing statement and talking about, you know, the surgeries that removed half the brain and the allusion to what's going on in Washington, that got a big response too. But you only have 6-7 minutes in a 10-candidate debate. You got to make the best of it.
Let's go to the kids' table now that you mention it, that earlier debate. Here's what we won't play them all, but South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham had something to say. Let's listen.
One thing I want to be clear about tonight, if you're running for president of the United States and you don't understand that we need more American ground forces in Iraq and that America has to be part of a regional ground force that will go into Syria and destroy ISIL in Syria, then you're not ready to be commander-in-chief.
Michael Bitzer, that seemed to come out of nowhere. It surprised a lot of people. What do you make of that?
Well, Lindsey Graham, I think, got into the race to be the opponent who's going to oppose Rand Paul and his kind of foreign policy purview. You know, it was unfortunate that Senator Graham and Senator Paul weren't on the stage at the same time, because I think that would have been a very interesting colloquy between the two of them. But certainly Lindsey Graham is representing the McCain wing of the Republican Party, a much more aggressive foreign policy stance, and going directly against and fighting Rand Paul's approach to it.
What do you think, Ken?
Well, you know something, I was just thinking, if you go back in history, you think of Woodrow Wilson's slogan was, he kept us out of war when he ran for re-election in 1916. FDR, when he ran in 1940, promised no World War II. Of course, that was a year later. It happened. Lyndon Johnson ran as the peace candidate in 1964 before Vietnam. Here's Lindsey Graham saying, if you elect me president, I'm going to send tens of thousands of American troops back into the Middle East. And that is pretty remarkable. But from the beginning, Lindsey Graham and John McCain have been talking about that when Obama and the Democrats did in Iraq was basically cut and run, because, as you know, America felt that we did not have enough war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We needed more of it. And so Lindsey Graham is basically saying, elect me and we're going to be back in there. But in fairness to Lindsey Graham, or at least to not be cute, he does say that if we don't defeat them there, if we don't defeat ISIS there, then we're going to have to defeat them here. And that's his argument for sending troops.
Well, Michael, you said it was too bad that he wasn't on the stage with Rand Paul. Rand Paul was on the stage with Chris Christie, and they got into it about NSA surveillance. Let's listen.
I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from innocent Americans. The Fourth Amendment was what we fought the revolution over. John Adams said it was the spark that led to our war for independence. And I'm proud of standing for the Bill of Rights, and I will continue to stand for the Bill of Rights.
And Megan, that's a completely ridiculous answer. I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from other people. How are you supposed to know, Megan?
Use the Fourth Amendment.
How are you supposed
to? Use the Fourth Amendment.
No, I'll tell you how you.
Get a warrant.
Let me tell you something.
Get a judge to sign a warrant.
Senator.
Go ahead. Wait, Governor Christie, make your point.
Listen, Senator, you know, when you're sitting in a subcommittee just blowing hot air about this, you can say things like that. When you're responsible for protecting the lives of the American people, then what you need to do is to make sure that you use the system the way it's supposed to.
Here's the problem, Governor. You fundamentally misunderstand the Bill of Rights. Every time you did a case, you got a warrant from a judge. I'm talking about searches without warrants, indiscriminately of all Americans' records, and that's what I fought to end. I don't trust President Obama with our records. I know you gave him a big hug, and if you want to give him a big hug again, go right ahead.
You know, Senator Paul, you know the hugs that I remember? Are the hugs that I gave to the families who lost their people on September 11th. Those are the hugs I remember.
I think this was exactly the quintessential American discourse in 2015, because it was a substantial debate about what our constitutional freedoms require, that you actually have a process, a due process, before you begin to prosecute people on a hunch they might be terrorists. On the other hand, filled with all kinds of inflammatory rhetoric that's emotional and off the point. I mean, sort of an amazing exchange, don't you think? Let me start with you, Michael.
I thought it was the fireworks of the evening, you know, setting aside both Donald Trump and Megan, the moderator. I thought that this was really the classic division on issues within the Republican Party. There were no hugs after the debate, I'm sure, between the two of them. But it really demonstrates that there are core policy principles and ideological beliefs that motivate within this Republican Party that are at the heart of who's going to be the representative going against the Democrats next fall. And this is really, I think, the development of this argument certainly played well for both both Governor Christie and Senator Paul. But I thought Governor Christie maybe had a little bit of an edge, and Senator Paul seemed a little too aggressive at times, kind of jumping in and trying to make his points.
What do you think, Ken?
Well, you know, this is, and I agree, this was the highlight substantively wise regarding policy in the debate. This is the historic conflict or the debate that's been going on for decades, privacy versus security. Rand Paul and his father, Ron Paul, before him, always felt that there's just too much government intrusion, that the Bill of Rights is far more important than just, you know, locking people up. And, of course, Chris Christie had the emotion of being he was a U.S. attorney during 9/11. He talked about the horrific days following that. And we saw this a few years ago, too, in a 2007-2008 debate between Rudy Giuliani and Ron Paul about what 9/11 was all about. So this was really not only within the Republican Party, but I think with the American people at large, debating and deciding what's more important, privacy or security.
Is that a conversation that's happening within the Republican Party or just at the Paul dinner table where there's a consensus about, you know, having to follow due process of law? It sounds to me like that's the debate between the Democrats and the Republicans. I feel like the Republicans are all in line about this. When we're in trouble, let's just put the Constitution over there and kind of get at them. Is this really a conversation, Michael Bitzer, within the Republican Party? Is this much of a debate within the Republican Party?
I think certainly, you know, the libertarian strain within the Republican Party, particularly on these civil kind of issues, is very much a core. And I think it's resonating particularly with younger voters that I have been teaching and talking to. You know, they are very much, I don't want the government, you know, tapping into my phones. I don't want the government's worry about who I'm in bed with. You know, just kind of stay out. So this libertarian strain is very much predominant, but you've also got the legacy of 9/11 and the policies that George W. Bush had in terms of trying to ensure the security of the country. And it is a very much a tension between the two philosophical ideas.
Well, I want to talk about other issues beyond the debate, political issues. On the Hill this week, a measure to defund Planned Parenthood failed in the Senate. But Republicans vowed the fight is not over. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren made a speech that went viral. Let's hear a bit of it.
I come to the Senate floor today to ask my Republican colleagues a question. Do you have any idea what year it is? Did you fall down, hit your head, and think you woke up in the 1950s or the 1890s? Should we call for a doctor? Because I simply cannot believe that in the year 2015, the United States Senate would be spending its time trying to defund women's health care centers.
What do you think, Ken? Is the GOP in trouble on this? Is this something that is going to be a problem for them in the general election or not?
Well, I mean, you can look at it the other way. You can look at these videos that were surreptitiously recorded that showed Planned Parenthood officials talking about selling fetal tissue from aborted fetuses to medical centers. So the Republicans say, if you look at these videos, how in God's name could you possibly support federal funding of Planned Parenthood? And I know that Planned Parenthood supporters, Barbara Boxer, Elizabeth Warren, even Hillary Clinton, who called the videos disgusting or alarming, I mean, they were on the defensive. But again, it also goes into the Democrats' mantra of running against the Republican Party as the Republican war on women, and Elizabeth Warren tried to do it she did it pretty effectively. But at the same time, you look at those videos, you know that so many Democrats, so many pro-choice Democrats really were just, you know, writhing and cringing looking at those videos.
Which way do you think it'll play out, Michael Bitzer?
I think it certainly is going to be a reinforcement of both the bases. What was interesting to me this week was an NBC poll had both Planned Parenthood and the National Rifle Association, two groups that are closely aligned with their respective political wings, basically being among the most admired groups within the country. And so you've got this kind of classic Second Amendment and women's health issues and reproductive rights and abortion, all kind of wrapped up in this one organization. And certainly it is going to be, I think, one of the hallmarks of going into the fall and maybe into the spring and the primary debates going on, you know, for this presidential contest.
Finally, the really big TV show last night, Jon Stewart said goodbye.
Finally, it's the bullshit of infinite possibility. These bullshitters cover their unwillingness to act under the guise of unending inquiry. We can't do anything because we don't yet know everything. We cannot take action on climate change until everyone in the world agrees gay marriage vaccines won't cause our children to marry goats who are going to come for our guns. Until then, I say teach the controversy. Now, the good news is this. Bullshitters have gotten pretty lazy, and their work is easily detected. And looking for it is kind of a pleasant way to pass the time. Like an eye spy of bullshit. So I say to you tonight, friends, the best defense against bullshit is vigilance. So if you smell something, say something.
Ken Rudin, you got 3 seconds. Jon Stewart, goodbye.
3 seconds? I think he can be holier than thou. He can be preachy, but he told it exactly like it was, and the politicians and the reporters knew better than to get involved in this kind of hypocrisy because he would have very effectively called you out on it.
Michael Bitzer.
Called it as he sees it.
There we go. Thank you very much. Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and provost at Catawba College. Thank you both. Just ahead, a conversation with jazz musician Kamasi Washington. Stay tuned.